A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Ram, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on January 24, 1999, in the series Q&Q, The Religious Quest and Question, entitled The Quest for the Historical Jesus. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 61, verses 1 through 4, and Luke 4, verses 14 through 30. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
You're in trouble today, huh? Whoa. I brought these to church, and I brought them to 8:30, and I didn't make reference to them, and they're heavy, and I don't really want to bring them to church without making any reference to them. There's some wonderful things I wanted to read, but I'm always criticized for reading wonderful things. It's better just to tell you about them. So let me just say that this came out a few years ago, not many years ago, The Historical Jesus, John Dominic Crossan. It's, you can see it's rather thick, 500 pages, and it became a bestseller. In a conversation with him, he said, "I never intended it to be a bestseller for popular consumption. I was trying to get a discussion going in the scholarly world." But he said it became a bestseller, and he said, "I think all kinds of people didn't really get it." So he wrote this one to try and explain what he was trying to do in the last one. This has got 640 pages or something. And since I won't have an opportunity to speak with you prior to the weekend in which John Dominic Crossan is with us, the first weekend in Lent, February 19 to 21, I want to take this opportunity to say a few words about him and about his work and the importance of the quest for the historical Jesus, because we have a lecture series this year which really focuses there. Certainly, John Dominic Crossan is considered one of, if not the preeminent historian and researcher in this quest, and Marcus Borg, widely published in the quest and colleague of Crossan. We have the Jewish scholar Amy Jill Levine, who will talk about the break between the Jesus movement and Judaism, and therefore focused again in those early years of origination. And then, of course, Bishop Spong, who will deal with the larger church and the larger theological issues in light of all of the biblical research that is going on. We are very fortunate to have these people come to us, and I want to say a word about John Dominic Crossan this morning, and Colette will follow up with that next week as well, because I think it's important to set a context for someone like this. John Dominic Crossan is a preeminent scholar. He is brilliant. When I read his work, when I see the kind of material that he marshals and how he handles it succinctly, communicating that breadth of study, I just cry and want to throw in the towel. I mean, it's just one of those brilliant scholars, but he is also able to communicate with people in a very wonderful way, a fine turn of phrase, memorable statements that he makes. Beyond that, John Dominic Crossan is a fine human being. I've only met him briefly, talked with him a couple of times, but others of you have been with him. And I want to say this to you as a congregation, that if you would expose yourself to this person, I'm sure you will like him, because he's not only brilliant, but he's gentle. And he is a person of great integrity. That impresses me so much. In the scholarly debates, it can get rather heated at times. But Dom Crossan is a person of great integrity who seeks to set forth his presuppositions, put them on the table, set forth clearly the method he's following, and then on that basis does his research. So you know how he is going about doing what he does, and therefore the conclusions that he reaches can be judged on that basis. He would not claim that his method is infallible or that his conclusions are absolute. Those who work in the field of historical research know that there is always a degree of probability connected with it. And we've known for a long time, and he's very quick to admit, that we will never get a photograph of the historical Jesus from the documentation that we have in the New Testament, the canonical Gospels, and in the non-canonical materials that were written about that time and other non-canonical Gospels out there. From all of that study, it is impossible to be absolutely certain that we have the exact contours of that mystical figure who stands behind it all. But through that kind of research, it is at least possible to get a good feel for Jesus, that one of whom we confess the Word made flesh, that one who in the Christian story is the concrete embodiment of God in our historical context. The Jesus who is our window to God, the center of our story as a part of that Christian tradition over 2,000 years. John Dominic Crossan is then a brilliant scholar, is a fine human being, and is a person of great integrity who with great passion pursues his research of the birth of Christianity. A very important scholar, and we're very privileged that he would come into our midst. As he will share with us in greater extent, we are engaged at the present time in a very vital discussion and a very vital research, seeking to find the contours of Jesus of Nazareth. The quest of the historical Jesus is going on with great passion and great intensity in our day. And it's a very important engagement. The historical Jesus is that figure behind the Gospels, behind the Apostle Paul, behind the Christian communities, behind the Christian creedal tradition. Crossan and others have been criticized for engaging in this research by some who would say, well, you've got Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. There is one writer who analyzes 20 such scholars and their research for the historical Jesus and says they're all wrong and they come to distorted conclusions because they never see the whole Jesus. They just look at parts. They fragment Jesus. Well, to that, Dom Crossan would say, the whole Jesus, which whole Jesus? The whole Jesus of Matthew or of Mark or of Luke or of John, because we know that those basic four canonical portraits differ considerably, not only in nuance, but even within those gospel records, We know that Jesus makes some contradictory claims, or contradictory claims are made about him. You've heard me say before that when I was going through college and studying Bible, we studied a course in the harmony of the Gospels, and we meshed it all together. And if there wasn't, you know, if there was a loose end dangling here, well, we had ways of getting rid of that. So we had one uniform portrait, the whole Jesus, so to speak. But when you really research the Gospels, you see you have varying portraits. And even within the Gospel, for example, within the same Gospel, Jesus will say, the end is imminent. This generation will not pass away before the Son of Man appears. And the end is unknown. Only the Father in heaven knows the time and season. Which did he mean? Did he say one thing one time and one thing another time? Did he change his mind? Or did he say one thing and his interpreters say another thing? Those are the kinds of questions that are asked. But as a matter of fact, you can't just say, well, read Matthew or Mark or Luke or John and get the whole Jesus. You have to say, which whole Jesus? And so there's work behind the scenes, because we recognize now that those Gospels are layered traditions. And each Gospel was written with a specific perspective to a concrete community in a concrete context in order to deal with certain things. What was needed to be said in John's time near the end of the first century was not the same as what Mark needed to communicate around 70 AD. All of the Gospels being decades after the event itself. All of the Gospels written reflecting a cumulative growing tradition in various Christian locales, dealing with various challenges and crises. That's just normal. I don't preach the same Jesus that I preached in 1960 when I came here the first time. And you can be happy about that. I don't preach the same Jesus that I preached in New Jersey. I don't preach the same Jesus I preached in 1971 when I came back. Part of that is my own growth and understanding, but part of that is the fact that you're not the same, and the world's not the same. And if preaching is to be, in any sense, relevant, the proclamation of the Word of God to concrete people in the here and now, then it will be an evolving kind of message. It will be pertinent to the context, time and space, locale, community, the crises and challenges that any people face at any given time. That's what draws preaching to its focus. And so it was with the Gospel writers. And so we have this canonical foursome that represent how that mystical figure back there was proclaimed here and here and here and here at respective times. But how do we get behind that? Well, that's the purpose of this historical research. And why is it important? Because Jesus is our window to God. And the kind of Jesus we envision will impact the kind of God we worship. And the kind of God we worship will determine the kind of people we are. The history of religion has been replete with examples of what Crossan would say, killer children of a killer God. If God is that way, then we are empowered and legitimized to be that way. So it's a very, very critical thing. And those Gospels, when you attack them carefully, in scholarly manner, will indicate those layers to those who are trained to do it. I didn't read, Colette didn't read from Mark, but I have a text printed in the liturgy from Mark, that third chapter where Jesus, in the blossoming of his Galilean ministry, the word is out that he is out of his mind. And his mother gets his brothers and they go to bring him home. because he's gone over the edge, according to rumor at least. Well, that kind of material, those who research would say, you know, that's not really very complimentary. That must have been such a hard nugget in that tradition that they couldn't wipe it out. Although Matthew softened Mark, and Luke doesn't refer to it at all. Jesus' mother going after him and saying, come home, boy. You've lost it. And in the Gospel of Luke, we have this wonderful inaugural sermon of Jesus in his home synagogue. And there he reads from the prophet Isaiah. It was the reading of the day, apparently. And he read those words of the prophet, which were read here from Isaiah 61. Except he left out one phrase. You caught that, I'm sure, didn't you? Didn't you? He said to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Period. Isaiah said, as was read here, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, the day of vengeance of our God. Jesus was a teddy bear. He didn't like to talk about God's vengeance. That's why he up and left John the Baptist. John the Baptist was talking about the day of vengeance because the year of the Lord's favor for the righteous was a year of God's vengeance on the wicked. So Jesus left that out. Selective, huh, Jesus? Or did Jesus read it, but Luke left it out? Can't really tell, can we? Somebody left it out. Isaiah said, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, the day of vengeance of our God. Either Jesus left it out because it was contrary to where he was going, spitting off John the Baptist, or where he was going, spitting off John the Baptist, impressed somebody enough so that in the growing tradition there was a sense that Jesus was not about vengeance. How do you tell? Well, you ask Dom Crossan. Well, it's difficult to tell. We probably can't tell. But do you see what this is all about? Trying to get back as best we can to that concrete historical figure in the misty flats behind those Gospels. But if the biblical text is a problem, it's even a bigger problem when you get the growing creedal tradition of the Christian movement. Dom Crossan will tell us that Jesus was one of the dispossessed and destitute persons of Lower Galilee, and that his movement gathered those who had lost everything. They didn't have to give up everything to follow Jesus. They didn't have anything. They were an itinerant group that went about to proclaim, and Jesus, and this was the marvelous thing, the amazing thing about Jesus, he was able to say to the destitute of the world, you can be kings and queens. You can live fully and fully human. If you lose your life, you'll gain it. Grasping life, you lose it. Jesus had something about him that made people stand and walk tall from the inside out. And so whatever started as a proclamation of good news to the poorest of the poor. It was a social movement. It had political and economic implications. And then the three centuries go by, and there is a Roman vying for imperial power, and his name is familiar to you all, Constantine, 312. He says, give me victory, I give you the empire. He wins. Christianity becomes the established religion of the Roman Empire. Absolutely amazing, isn't it, when you think about it? 300 years and a leap from a peasant movement by the dispossessed to imperial power, the religious establishment of the Roman Empire. But there were strings attached. Constantine called a council, a church council. This is the emperor now calling a church council in 325, the Council of Nicaea. And like with the MBA boys, Constantine locked up the bishops and he said, come out with a uniform statement about the nature of this one and relationship to God. And the Council of Nicaea came out with a creed, the Nicene Creed. If you're from the Catholic tradition, it's the creed recited at every Mass. On the 21st of February here, our choir will chant the Nicene Creed. It'll give you goosebumps. Light of light, God of God, before all worlds. Now, to celebrate their victory, coming out with a creed, Constantine threw the bishops a supper. And there is a marvelous statement from the church historian Eusebius who shows how the bishops walked through the rows of armed soldiers, the legionnaires. They walk into the royal apartments, into the depths, into the dining room, where they recline on couches and sup with the emperor, the bishops. Wow, that's seductive. I mean, it would be for any of us. When you know the marvelous novel Thorn Birds, when Nancy and I were watching that as a movie form one time, when Father Ralph is all regaled in brilliant red robes and he prostrates himself and on that shiny marble of St. Peter's with all of the gold and glitter around, I said to Nancy, you know what? I was made for glory. I mean, it's seductive. I mean, here we are, a bunch of nobodies, and somebody lifts us up and invites us to a royal banquet. Well, I could distort quite a few texts as a gift in turn. The church tradition from that point on continually elevated its Christological creedal statements. Because if the emperor is going to bow the knee to Jesus, Jesus better be the Lord of the universe. So he becomes Pantocrator, the ruling, reigning Jesus Christ, Lord of the worlds. I can understand how that happened. If it hadn't happened, would we be here today? I don't know. Could a poor peasant movement in Lower Galilee ever have swept the world without achieving that escalation? I don't know. But can you see that you'd lose something too? Wouldn't establishment take the heart out of the heart of that movement? Seems like it just common sense, just makes sense that inevitably is going to happen. Well, you see, you've got layers in the text, and now you've got credo layers in the tradition. So, how are you going to get back there? Or why should you? Well, let me suggest it's important because the triumphalism of an imperial an imperial established church isn't going over so well in our world today. Don't we have a suspicion that the church is not going to be the triumphant institution of the world? Don't we realize that the great religious traditions are reviving to gain their own place in the sun? Aren't we recognizing the necessity, the importance, the enhancement and enrichment of the interfaith dialogue? Elsie and Hung Liang are back in town, and Elsie called and told about how Priscilla in Singapore, Priscilla, Chinese, raised in America, now in Singapore and networked in an international community. A young Indian so upset with her death that he went off to Nepal for a month of prayer and fasting. And Buddhist friends gathering their community in prayers for Priscilla and for the rest of her soul. What would you say if your daughter was dying, or if your daughter had died and somebody from another tradition said, "We're praying for you"? Would you say, "Well, could I check your creed to see if it has any credence"? Of course you wouldn't. We know these things down here. We know that all of us in the great movements of religious faith throughout the world are reaching for rest in that ultimate mystery of things. And so, we live in a time of disestablishment. That's what Douglas Hall said to us when he was here that weekend. The Constantinian era is over. We live in a global community in a pluralistic situation where there is mutual interfacing between the great religious traditions and a triumphalistic church, and a triumphalistic Lord Jesus Christ isn't going to do it in our world. But Jesus still does. The great Albert Schweitzer, concert organist, a brilliant biblical scholar, theologian, by the age of 30 years, by that time he had written his classic, The Quest of the Historical Jesus, had written about Paul and the kingdom, had been a pupil of Charles Marie Vidor and studied with Franz Liszt, leading pupil, could have played organ around the world. He is an accomplished theologian, an accomplished professional musician, and he goes to medical school at age 30 to learn to be a doctor, to go to Africa, where he lived his life out in that humanitarian gift to those people. Why? In his quest of the historical Jesus, from which our hymn came, because it's his poetic words, he comes to us as one unknown. He says that Jesus was wrong, dead wrong. He got it wrong. Jesus thought the end was there. Jesus thought he could get God to act. Jesus, in a desperate action, cast himself on the wheel of history, and it didn't budge. But then it began to move, and it crushed him. Jesus, Albert Schweitzer said, was wrong. Dominic Crossan will tell us that further research has said that probably Jesus did not expect the imminent end of the world. But that's another story for Schweitzer. Jesus was wrong. A marvelous martyr. But did he leave Christianity? No. Instead, he emulated Jesus and went to Africa. He gave up promising careers in music and in theology, and he becomes a doctor for people in Africa. Why? Because Jesus got to him. That Jesus who was the embodiment of God by the Spirit of God, that same Spirit moving in a Schweitzer who says Jesus was wrong about that, therefore certainly not this exalted creedal Christ, but by God he's what being human is all about. It is what following God is all about. It is about building world community, which is what Jesus was all about. Schweitzer followed Jesus. And I want to follow Jesus. And I believe you want to follow Jesus. And that's why it's so critical that we get the best take on him we can. Because the closer we look, the better he looks.